Dark Side of the Ring Season 3 kicked off this past week. The Chris Benoit and Owen Hart episodes of the show were extremely tough to watch, especially if you live through those times as a fan. Probably have a lot of sad memories about it. I can remember, for example, where I was and what I was doing when, you know, I learned about what happened to some of these people. And to sit here and relive all of it again, you know, as we did in those episodes, and hear from the family members, to hear from the children, you know, it rips your heart out of your chest. The second half, more so than the first, of the Brian Pillman episode, which, much like those other two, was a double episode, I found that to be very similar for me. You know, more than any of the stuff that happened to Pillman himself, which I already knew about a lot of that stuff, was the effect that his decisions and his actions and his family life had on the other members of his family and had on his children. And how heartbreaking it was to listen to his daughter, Brittany, and to listen to Brian Jr., you know, what he went through with his abusive stepfather was awful. The worst parts of the entire episode. You know, Pillman was no saint. But what he was driven to prove that he could make a lot of money and he could be a main event player in pro wrestling. And he would have been, had he not gotten into that Humvee wreck. You know, much like the Gino Hernandez episode and a lot of the other names that were cut down in their prime, Pillman will always be one of those great what-if stories in wrestling, because for all the success that he did have, I mean, here we are talking about him still all these years later, he barely scratched the surface of what he was capable of being. They did lots of interviews for this one, including Steve Austin, his former tag team partner, on the set of his Broken Skull Sessions, which I thought was very interesting. You know, Evan Husney, one of the co-creators of the show, I saw, told the New York Post that they were also able to get access to Jerry McDevitt, WWE lawyer Jerry McDevitt, the legendary Jerry McDevitt, who's been defending Vince McMahon for a few decades now. And they were able to interview him and get access to him for their episode on the Vince McMahon steroid trial that airs later this season. So they have opened up access to people, even maybe just on a limited basis, it seems, in WWE. Jim Ross was interviewed, Eric Bischoff, Jim Cornette, Dave Meltzer, who was good friends with Pillman, Pillman's sister, Linda, who basically became a second, you know, mother in a lot of ways to his children after he passed away, Brian's widow, Melanie. Time has not been kind to Melanie Pillman. She was almost unrecognizable. Two of Pillman's daughters and his son, Brian. But Kim Wood was the real star of this documentary. He was fantastic in this. He was a strength and conditioning coach in the NFL for almost 30 years for the Cincinnati Bengals, which is a team that Brian played for at one point. And that's where he got to know Kim and they became good friends. And it was Kim Wood, when Brian suffered an ankle injury when he was playing in the CFL and couldn't play football anymore, who suggested that he look into training in the Hart Family Dungeon in Calgary. And his sister Linda talked early on in the special about a lot of the issues he had with his throat from back when he was just a small child. He would develop a lot of polyps and constantly would have to have them removed. And he ended up having well over 30 or 40 surgeries because each time they would get rid of the polyps, they would grow back. And obviously you want to make sure they don't, you know, turn cancerous or anything like that. It was obstructing his breathing. There was one story they told about, you know, he needed an emergency tracheotomy and the doctor's house was closer than the hospital. And so they did this procedure on the dining room table in this doctor's house where, you know, they basically punctured a hole in his throat and performed a tracheotomy to try to save this poor kid's life. So that would attribute for the raspy voice that he had. And he was still having surgeries on his throat even later in life. I mean, there was some times he had a miss from WCW because he had to have another surgery on his throat. So it wasn't just a childhood problem that went away. He had, you know, again, tens of surgeries, dozens of surgeries on his throat over the years. I said Meltzer is one of the people who was interviewed in this. Meltzer and Pillman, they were very good friends. And Pillman and Meltzer started trading tapes, which is how they got to know one another. And it was by Meltzer writing about Brian so much in The Observer that Jim Ross says he learned about Pillman and ultimately got him signed to a contract in WCW. And JR made the comment, he said, Dave was always a pretty good gauge for talent. Which is sure to piss a lot of people off, I'm sure. But then they get into some of the family stuff, and, you know, his sister talked about Brian's first wife, Rochelle, who Brian met at a club, and they lived together in Calgary. Ultimately, they moved down to Atlanta. That's where his daughter, Brittany, was born. They interviewed Brittany for this and said that when he wasn't wrestling and he wasn't on the road, his kids were his life. And Brittany thought that she was his oldest daughter for a while. Turns out that that was not the case, and she comes to find out later on that he has another daughter named Danielle, or Danny, who was 2 years older than she was, born to a different mother. And they interviewed Danny for this, and she said Brian met her mom at a bar. It was a very brief love affair. And she was born while Brian was still with Rochelle, and her mom tried to keep it quiet for a while, but, you know, a girl needs her father. And when Brian found out about it, he didn't run from it. He embraced it. And she said that he was great. He was there for her all the time. And, yeah, they again, when they get deeper into the family stuff, at the end of the day, I mean, it's nice that Brian cared about his kids and all, but they're very open about the fact that, you know, he was cheating on this woman. You know, Brittany said, look, she knows that her dad cheated on her mom many, many times, but she stayed with him. There was a weird story that came out of nowhere, it felt like, about Rochelle, I guess when Brian was at a show, being attacked by a man who was trying to rob her, and he stabbed her in the face, he stabbed her in the cheek with an ice pick. I was like, I mean, that's horrible, but I was like, well, that was unexpected. That's like something you would see out of a Friday the 13th movie. And obviously she survived, but I'm sure that was quite the harrowing experience. So on the wrestling front, they talked about the Hollywood Blondes team with Austin and Pillman and WCW. Stone Cold said he was pissed. You know, when Pillman came up to him in the hallway one day and said, hey, you know, we should talk about our finish. And Austin said, what are you talking about? He goes, you and I, we're a tag team now. And nobody bothered to tell Austin this. And he was furious because he thought he was, you know, on the right path as a single star. He never had any aspirations to be a tag team wrestler. He wanted to be a singles guy. So he was not happy about it at first. Over time, obviously, they became good friends. He warmed to the idea. Their death knell came. It was a Clash of the Champions match. It was the Blondes against Ric Flair and Arn Anderson. It did a bad rating on TBS. And Cornette said that, Flair wasn't going to be the one to get the blame. And that was pretty much the beginning of the end of the Hollywood Blondes. And Austin is actually still kind of bent out of shape to this day about the fact that they broke them up without there being any real explanation. That's usually a Vince McMahon specialty, where he'll just break up teams for no reason. But this was going on in WCW back then as well. So Pillman meets Melanie, falls in love, and the problem there is that he is still married to Rochelle. So they eventually divorce, and things get really dark. I mean, I thought things got dark in the second hour of that Macho Man documentary on A&E. That was nothing compared to this. And Melanie is talking about, you know, this situation where they were going to file for custody over Rochelle's daughter, Brittany. And that caused, you know, a lot of drama within the family, and you know, it's something that Melanie regrets to this very day. Brittany says that she just thinks, she made it very clear what she thinks of Melanie Pillman. She says that Melanie is literally the devil. She is the devil, which means she'll probably end up living to be 100, but she'll have to live with all the shit that she's caused and the things that she's done. And, you know, for her part in this documentary, Melanie Pillman is she does say she has a lot of regrets and she's very apologetic for certain things. Now, whether or not she's being sincere, I don't know. You know, there's been a lot of stories and not very good about this woman over the years. So is this her trying to make herself look good and cover her ass? Probably that's part of it. And then in other ways, she probably is legitimately remorseful. But when you really, you know, and they didn't even cover all the stories about her here on the documentary. I think it's completely understandable why Britney would feel the way that she feels. She's talking about one day riding her bike. Britney, when she was young, she was riding her bike outside and her mom came to see her. Technically, she wasn't allowed to visit her, but her mother wanted to see her daughter. Well, Brian and Melanie see this and they think that she's trying to abduct her. And so they file for kidnapping, kidnapping charges. Brian ends up with full custody. This obviously wrecked Rochelle because she had her daughter taken away from her. And Britney says that her mom, you know, was worried that she would never see her again. And she called one day to talk to Brian. But Melanie answered the phone and told Rochelle, even your own mother thinks that I would be a better mother to Britney than you would ever be. Which is a pretty fucking evil thing to say to somebody. And Rochelle ends up calling her mother and tells her that she's going to commit suicide, and then she ends up shooting herself. There's no happy ending to that story. It's just fucking awful. Now, Eric Bischoff is interviewed in this, and he was talking about the fact that Brian was looking for more money. He wanted to renew or re-sign a new deal at $400,000. Eric couldn't give him that much money. And, you know, Pillman huddled with Kim Wood and said, what do I have to do here? What do you suggest? And really, the beginnings of this loose cannon persona really stem from conversations that he had with Kim Wood, where he said, look, what is it that you can do to make yourself stand out? You're in an industry where, you know, people thrive on that. They thrive on controversy, colorful characters, charismatic people who, you know, kind of drive attention to themselves. What is it that you can do to put the spotlight on yourself? Drive up your value. That's what led to the loose cannon character. So the idea was they wanted Eric Bischoff to offer him a lot of money. Vince McMahon would hear about this and he would offer Pillman money. He would basically start a bidding war to get himself a better deal. And would probably then stick with WCW because it sounds like that's really where he thought he would, you know, belong. I mean, WCW is kind of like a home to him. He thought he would fit in better there. They had footage of the Clash of the Champions, not pay-per-view, but event. Pillman was in a match with Eddie Guerrero. And he goes out to the floor. The announcers are sitting at ringside, Tony Schiavone and Bobby the Brain Heenan. And he grabs Heenan by the back of his jacket collar. And he didn't tell Heenan that he was going to do this. And Heenan has a bad neck, going back to, I think, even before he was in WWE. I actually think he broke his neck in Japan in the early 80s. So he had always had a bad neck. Even all those years, he was bumping around for Hogan and Warrior on WWE television and the Boss Man and whoever else he feuded with. He had a bad neck. He didn't want anybody going near his neck. And people, you know, were probably starting to think that Pillman was legitimately nuts and he didn't know what he was going to do. So he freaked out and he dropped an F-bomb live on the air on TBS. And they show Heenan, you know, he's spooked. He stands up and grabs his jacket and he goes and he walks to the back. And eventually, I think he came back out and apologized. But that was a memorable scene. They show the footage of the match with Pillman and Kevin Sullivan at Super Brawl. They had a strap match. Pillman grabs the mic. I respect you, Booker man. Sullivan was doing the booking at the time. And he leaves. So then they get into this whole thing about Pillman hatching this idea. You know, he and Kim Wood. That he would ask for his release. But he would tell Bischoff, look, I don't really want my release. It's all just an angle. It's to get people talking. But it's got to be real. Because if it's not real, the office is going to tell Dave Meltzer that it's all a work. And so what does Bischoff do? Bischoff gives him an actual legal release. He has the legal department draw up actual release papers and gives them to Pillman. And Cornette couldn't believe it. Austin couldn't believe it, that the plan actually worked. Bischoff, of course, to this very day, does not buy into the argument that he got worked, that he was made a fool of. His side of the story is that, yeah, it was a real release, but it was kind of understood between us. I was privy to all of Brian's plans. I knew exactly what he was going to do. We were in on this together. He said he told Brian to go to the WWF because he couldn't give him the money that he was offering. And then he promised him that he would bring him back eventually and be able to pay him more because he would be worth more after being in WWE for a while. But he's very defensive about people who say, oh, you were worked. Of course, not a fucking person in the world actually believed this, except perhaps Eric Bischoff himself. He's trying to save face. Kim Wood had a great quote here. He had a lot of them. But one of his great quotes was here. He goes, you know, that's the greatest thing that you could do. If you can fuck somebody over and convince them that it's a great idea. He goes, there's nothing better. He said, that's the trick in breaking up with a woman. Make her think it's her idea. So he also said that the real marks here were always Eric Bischoff and Vince McMahon. They were the real marks. And they ask him, they go, so what were your thoughts at that time of Vince McMahon? And Kim Wood goes, you know what you would do with a whore? You fuck him. That's what I thought of Vince McMahon. He goes, that's what I think of Vince McMahon. The man has a way with words. I will say that. But he said, look, it didn't matter where Brian ended up, because the producers were asking him that as well. Did it matter? Did he have a preference? And, you know, again, maybe WCW was his preferred destination, but he said it didn't matter where Brian ended up. It's money. The bottom fucking line, he said, money. He goes, these people in this business, they're living in fantasy land. They're all marks for themselves. It's about money. So Pillman has the Humvee wreck. I know I've talked about it on the podcast before. It's been talked about a lot. Almost dies. He's thrown from the Humvee 50 feet. If he was wearing his seatbelt, he very likely would have been crushed. So him not wearing his seatbelt actually worked to his advantage. But they rush him to the hospital. His face is swollen like a beach ball. He's got half a dozen different doctors, each one assigned to a different part of his head and face. They had specialists devoted to different parts of his face. They had to cut into his scalp and peel his face down. They had to peel his face back. Which reminds me, I have not seen Face Off in many years. I should watch that movie again soon. One of the last good things that John Travolta ever did. But his ankle was shattered, had to be fused into a walking position, which effectively killed his career. I mean, I know he came back and he wrestled. He did get back in the ring, but he was never the same again. I mean, he could barely do anything. He was in constant pain, had no business being back in the ring at all. You know, Jim Cornette said a lot of the boys in the business thought that the accident may have been all fabricated, his injuries and everything, that it was all fake, just because they thought the guy was nuts. They thought it was all part of the work. It was all part of the gimmick. There was a rumor at the time, and they have audio footage from some radio show, I guess in Cincinnati or something, that Pillman called into, and even one of the radio hosts asked about this rumor going around that he didn't really have this big wreck, but he was having plastic surgery to look like Shawn Michaels so he can come to WWE and face him in a match, which would be a hell of an angle, by the way. Pillman and Michaels could have had a hell of a feud. You know, we think about Pillman and Austin, but Pillman and Michaels, 1996, Shawn Michaels, 1997. And they were both all pilled up at the time, even before the wreck. Pillman was taking pills and stuff. Michaels was on God knows what. You know, bad for their health, obviously, and bad for their families and all that. But man, you know, hey, pilled up Shawn Michaels in 1997, there was nobody better in wrestling. You go back and watch his matches back then when he was doing all that stuff, he was fucking amazing. So Imagine that. Pillman from that era, if he was healthy and not in the wreck against Shawn Michaels from that era. Shit. There's a dream match right there. The car wreck happens at a time when he's in the middle of negotiations with the two companies, and he's trying to keep quiet just how bad his injuries really are. If either company knew how badly he was hurt, neither one of them would have wanted to sign this guy. But the object was to play them both against each other and play Vince McMahon for money, and Vince McMahon ends up offering him a 3-year deal with guaranteed money, which nobody else was getting at that time in that company. Everybody from back then talks about Vince didn't give guarantees. He would tell people, I don't give guarantees, I give you an opportunity. Well, Pillman got a guarantee. Now, what he was getting was less than what WCW was offering, but I guess the WCW deal, and I've talked about this before too, there was an out clause. So for example, if I remember correctly, after 90 days, I think every 90 days, WCW would have been able to release him from his contract. So in his mind, it was probably only a matter of time if they saw that his injuries were worse than they originally knew about and that he wasn't really able to perform, well, then WCW certainly would have cut him. So he took the safer bet with WWE. They have footage of the angle with him and Austin when Austin Pillmanized the ankle, which is an expression that's still used to this day. I still use it every time on the podcast if I'm talking about a match or an angle where somebody gets a chair wrapped around their neck or their ankle. I still call it they're being Pillmanized to this very day. Pillman had a surgery coming up, so they did that angle to explain why he was going to be off TV for a while. They had footage of the gun angle on Raw in, I guess that would have been, what was that, October or November? I think November of 1996. Which was very controversial at that time. And Vince McMahon, they had footage of him apologizing on Livewire the weekend after because USA Network was not very happy about that. But Pillman was bound and determined to get back into the ring. And he was taking more and more pain pills. He would just take pills until the pain went away. So who knows? Who knows if he knew how many pills he was taking? You take as much as you have to make the pain go away. You know, Meltzer says he could barely walk through an airport. He looked like an old man. But yet there he was in the ring taking bumps. And, you know, JR had people coming to him and saying, look, you know, there's something wrong with Brian. He's not doing too well. And so JR is the head of talent relations, and he says, we're going to drug test him. And he called up, I forgot who it was, one of the road agents at the next live event, and said, when he gets there, I guess, you know, hey, make him piss in a cup. Brian felt betrayed by this, and JR said to him, look, we're just trying to save your life here, dude. So Pillman calls Meltzer to vent. Says he felt singled out, told Dave, look, all they're going to find in me are prescription drugs. And the test comes back, and it was prescription drugs and steroids. But he, you know, his attitude was, everybody's doing it. Why am I being singled out over everybody else? So then it comes to Pillman's death, the day of the Bad Blood In Your House pay-per-view in October of 97, the night of the very first Hell in a Cell match with Undertaker and Shawn Michaels is marred by the announcement at the beginning of the show that Brian Pillman was found dead in his hotel room in, I believe it was Minneapolis. And Jim Cornette tells the story about, you know, how they found out. He was the first person to know. You know, usually for a pay-per-view, guys are at the building by 1 o'clock. Well, it was 5 o'clock, and nobody knew where Pillman was, and he had a match that night. So he calls the hotel, somebody answers, and they tell him that, you know, Pillman is dead. And Cornette, at first, he's figuring, okay, what's he up to? He's thinking it's a rib. And they mention that the police are there, and then he realizes that it's not a joke. And he goes and tells somebody, go get Bruce. And they're like, well, Bruce is busy doing a go get Bruce. Pillman is dead, and he gets all choked up. You'll see Cornette get choked up very often. It happened during the Owen Hart special. Happened again here. You can understand why. I mean, you know, it takes you back to a period. Look, those are dark days. These guys work together on the road. They travel together. I'm not saying, you know, Cornette and Pillman specifically, but, you know, Pillman at the time is early 30s, early to mid 30s. You're not supposed to be getting a phone call that somebody at that age that you know was found dead. It affects you. That shit doesn't go away. You know, here we are 23 years later and the guy's getting choked up just thinking back to what was happening that night. Now, one of the more damning things in this special was Raw the following night, which I believe is the first instance I can remember of WWE doing a 10-bell salute with all the wrestlers gathered on stage like that. Unfortunately, we've had a lot more of that in the years since, but I think Pillman was the first, and certainly it was the first time they did a kind of like a tribute show. They turned Raw into a tribute show. But it's remembered for the Vince McMahon interview. Via satellite, he interviewed the widow of Brian Pillman. He interviewed Melanie on television 24 hours after they broke the news of his death. I don't remember exactly what time he would have been pronounced dead the day before, so it had been a little over 24 hours since this guy had passed away, and now his wife, who, you know, had to agree to come on the air, so she had to say yes. She could have said no. She did say yes. But she agrees to come on the show, and she says here in the special, her only request for Vince McMahon was for him to not ask any questions about drugs. Because even she didn't know what the cause of death was. Now, the cause of death ended up being, you know, heart disease, and he had a heart attack, I think. But it was heart-related. But they didn't know that yet, because the death certificate hadn't even been issued. That was, in her words, her only request. Just don't ask any questions about drugs or, you know, what may have caused it. And the very first question that Vince asked her about is about pain pills. And they show footage of the interview. You can see the moment where she kind of makes a face. And she says she made that face because she specifically told him not to ask about that. And it's the first fucking thing that came out of this guy's mouth. And she says she wishes that she was there live so that she could slap him in the face because he had promised her that he wouldn't ask about that. Then he's got the balls to ask her later on, well, what are you going to do now? You're a single mother of five kids. What are you going to do? Who asks questions like this to a grieving widow 24 hours after her father has passed away? It was sick then, and it's sick now. It's not that it makes Vince McMahon look worse. He looked bad then. This just reminds you, watching it, what a fucking scumbag he is. Talk about Pillman's funeral. Vince and JR were there, as were Kim Wood and Dave Meltzer. Wood actually picked Meltzer up, and they drove in together. The funeral was open casket. And they talked about the kids not really understanding what was going on because they were so young. You know, the oldest was 7 years old. Brian Jr. was only four. And they, you know, they did, I think he was four. But they were very young. And they didn't mention this in the documentary, but Kim Wood did an interview on the Observer site after it aired. And he and Dave talked about the funeral, and they talked about the kids literally climbing into the casket with Brian to say goodbye. They just turned and looked at each other because of how fucking weird it all was, that there's just kids everywhere just crawling in and out of the casket. Now, Brian Jr. in the past has talked about how his mother blew through all of her dad's money and the money from the you know, Brian Pillman memorial shows that Les Thatcher helped put together. He helped raise over $100,000 for the family through those shows. And Brian says that she blew it all. She bought a truck for her new husband with the money. Now, that's from an interview that Pillman Jr. did a few years ago. But this is, to me, this is where, this was the worst part of the whole thing, is watching and listening to Pillman's son get choked up and get very emotional and talked about a lot of the abuse, the physical abuse, the psychological abuse that he had to endure at the you know, at the hands of his stepfather. This woman, you know, married this piece of garbage who would have dogs trained in the hallway right outside of Brian Jr.'s bedroom to kind of like guard the room and make sure that he didn't leave. And if he tried to, they were trained to attack him. So he was essentially held hostage in his own room by these dogs outside his door. And because he really wasn't able to socialize, he didn't make any friends, he didn't develop socially, he never learned how to throw a football, he never learned how to throw a baseball. Nobody ever did any of that stuff with him. You know, he wasn't very athletic. The one thing he was good at, he played games, because he was always by himself in his room, so he played video games. And he had a GameCube, you know, back when Nintendo had the GameCube console. And he can remember his stepdad finding out about it, coming in and taking the GameCube and just tossing it and smashing it against the wall. He wouldn't even let him play games. Now, and he was talking about the fact that everything he tried to latch onto was just yanked away from him. But Melanie is, again, she's very apologetic in parts and remorseful about certain things, and she says all she wants is for her kids not to be mad at her before she dies. And Brian Jr. says, you know, my dad's not here anymore. All I have is my mom. As far as, you know, like a blood relative, close relative, parents, right? You only have one mom and one dad. And his mom is still here. His dad is not. And he has made efforts to rekindle his relationship with her. And it's made him, he says, a better man. He's very happy that he at least still has a parent still left on this earth. And at the end of it, they talked about how Brian Jr. has followed in his dad's footsteps. He's getting into wrestling. You know, he was in MLW for a time. Now he's in AEW. Linda Pillman is an absolute saint. That's Brian's sister, who's basically taken to helping, I don't want to say raise the kids, but basically keeping the family together. And she's kind of the de facto parent now for them all. She is just an absolute angel in this special. But I think at the end of the day here, you know, Pillman's legacy is that he successfully created this character that ended up landing him the big contract that he craved. He just wanted to make more money and move up the ladder and provide for his family. He had all these kids. And he tried to figure out, what can I do to make myself stand out? I'm not the biggest. I'm not the toughest. I'm not a main event level guy. Not yet. What can I do? And he was successful in creating this persona and getting a lot of people in the wrestling business thinking that this guy is off his rocker. This guy is nuts. But then in a cruel twist of fate, he screwed himself out of what should have been the opportunity of a lifetime. And by all accounts, he probably would have wound up back in WCW at some point because, again, he viewed that as his home. But he would have been a massive star. He stayed healthy, he would have been a massive star during that Attitude Era. He could have easily been trading that championship back and forth with Steve Austin in 98. Especially, you know, if Brett leaves, and these are a lot of what-ifs, but if Brett leaves, as he did, and Shawn has the back injury and he leaves, as he did, they would have needed someone like Pillman to help fill that void. But what his kids have been through, they deserve some happiness in their lives. I came away from this wanting to see Brian Jr. go on to become a big star and achieve all the things that his father never did because, you know, he got cut down at such a young age. He's got a lot of people rooting for him after this. I can guarantee you that. Now, we have a schedule here for the remainder of the first half of this season. They're breaking it up into two parts. The second half of the season, I think, is coming up later on in the summer. This Thursday is May 13. That is the Ultraviolence of Nick Gage. And the description is, Nick Gage is the self-proclaimed king of deathmatch wrestling, but his road to the top has been marked with a 6-year prison sentence for armed robbery and personal tragedies. So that's the next episode coming up this Thursday. The following Thursday on the 20th is Collision in Korea, which was the well, back-to-back days. They had wrestling matches in North Korea. I just talked about this in the history segment this week. Ric Flair has talked about it before. Scott Norton was there. A lot of people were there. Very interesting story. We'll see how they stretch that out into an entire episode. May 27th is Becoming Warrior. The Ultimate Warrior was a divisive force in and out of the ring. His first wife reveals how an aspiring chiropractor morphed himself into wrestling's most polarizing figure. So they found the Warrior's first wife and interviewed her for this special. And remember, Warrior is getting the A&E treatment as well. And that is done in cooperation with WWE. These are not. Very curious to see how different these two are. Just the nature of this. It's called Dark Side of the Ring, so you know it's going to be darker. It's in the name of the show. But I'm still very curious to see what is covered here as compared to what is covered on the A&E special in a few weeks. June 3rd, In the Shadow of Grizzly Smith. I think this is going to be the darkest one of them all. Having survived familial abuse at the hands of their father and the mysterious abduction of their sister, Jake the Snake and his siblings struggle to reconcile with their past. I feel like I'm going to need a therapy session when that episode is over. I mean, you had me at Jake in terms of the darkness of it, but you look up Grizzly Smith, this is not going to be a fun episode. And on June 10th, it is the Dynamite Kid. Dynamite Kid earned worldwide fame with a riveting, self-sacrificing style, but violent confrontations outside the ring would destroy his family, his body, and his legacy. So they're getting real dark this season. But it's a well-done show. They take great pains not to sensationalize things too much. You know, they have the reenactments during the show, which I like. It kind of reminds me of when I used to watch Unsolved Mysteries many years ago. When Robert Stack used to host, they would have these reenactments. That's kind of what it reminds me of. But anyway, I will be doing these reviews weekly. We'll probably keep them to the YouTube channel. And we'll be talking about Nick Gage, I guess, coming up next week. So check out episode 703 of the full podcast, which went up this weekend. A lot of news to cover. A lot of other reviews as well. Talked about the Macho Man documentary, some other documentary stuff, and all the news of the week. And I'll see you back here real soon for more Dark Side of the Ring. Take care, guys.